storm.
I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Welcome to our travel podcast. We're specialist travel writers, and we've spent half a lifetime exploring every corner of the world.
So we want to share with you some of our extraordinary experiences and the amazing people we've met along the way.
This week, we're talking to wild swimmer Simon Murray. His international company, SwimTrek, takes groups of open water enthusiasts to all corners of the world. All he needs is a pair of speedos, goggles, a hat, and the ability to swim a few kilometres in the warm waters of the Mediterranean or the Caribbean, or perhaps the rather chillier North Atlantic. Simon, really good to have you on the podcast. First of all, tell us how open water swimming began for you.
Yeah, so my mother was a highboard diver. So I remember her, as I was a kid, used to take me diving. My father, he was a surf lifeguard from Sydney. And then they both came over here to the UK. So he had a love of open water swimming. And then my mum also loved swimming in the Thames. So although the diving didn't work on me, she persevered with taking me down the Thames for my summer holidays. And I remember sitting on the banks of the Thames. She'd have a Radio Times and a picnic blanket and a Radio 4 blasting out all day. And I'd sit next to her with a couple of comics and would sort of sit there and go swimming in the Thames every sort of hour next to the fishermen. And this was in the 1970s, early 1980s, when open water swimming was definitely not the sort of the trendy thing it is now. And anyway, something obviously sort of rubbed off there. So I'd say it's down to both my mum and my dad that sort of had this sort of fascination and interest in open water swimming. And I think the first significant swim that got my interest was the Hellespont in Turkey, which was made famous by Lord Byron swimming across it, who actually swam it in honor of Leander, who in Greek mythology would swim across the Hellespont to his lover Hero. Hero was on the European side at a castle of Sestos, and she would hold out a torch, and Leander, who was on the Asian side in a castle at Abydos, would swim across. She would hold out the torch, they would do their thing, and then later that night he would swim back. And then one night a storm blew, and Hero's torch was extinguished, and Leander lost his way and was drowned. His body washed up underneath Sestos Castle, and Hero, seeing his body, threw herself off the castle and died alongside Leander. And that was the tragic Greek love story of Hero and Leander. And Byron recreated that swim, and with a Lieutenant Colonel Eckenhead, was the first person to swim the Hellespont. And I remember reading a poem that Byron did. I was a mining engineer at the time in northern Nigeria on the border with Niger. I remember reading it as a schoolboy, but then I remember being up in this mining and a long way from any water and thinking, what's my passion in life? What do I really enjoy doing? And I remember I loved open water swimming, and I always enjoyed finding the most bizarre places to swim. And I remember rereading that poem from Byron and thinking, you know what, when I turn 30, that's what I'm going to do. And so when I did turn 30, that's what I did. I went over to northwestern Turkey and went to the town of Çanakkale, and I managed to find a pilot and get various permissions. I needed a military permission because the Hellespont is also known as the Dardanelles, famous military campaign in World War I, and it's straight across from Gallipoli. I needed military permission from the army, but also the navy, and also permission from the coast guard and the town council. It took me a week to get the permission and find the pilot, and about just over an hour to swim it. So that total imbalance of time with hassle and everything made me think, well, there must be other people out there who also want to do these fantastic swims around the world, but don't want to do all the admin, don't want to do all the organization and safety support. And that was also, that was my love of open water swimming blossom then, but also the idea behind what I do today, which is SwimTrek, which is taking people out on these fantastic swims. So that's where the idea came from.
So how far across the Hellespont is it? How many kilometers?
Well, at the nearest point, it's just a kilometer across from Europe to Asia. But if you headed out from those castles at Kilitbehir is where one of the castles is, which was a fortified during the Dardanelles campaign in World War I. If you started out from there, you would quickly be washed out into the Mediterranean. So you've got to start off a lot higher up. So you start off at the town of Echabat, and you get pushed down as you swim across. You move down with the current toward the Mediterranean, but also towards the ancient city of Troy. And you end up near where Troy is, and you get washed down. So in effect, you're probably swimming 3.5 kilometers, but the journey you go on is about 5 kilometers, but you're probably doing an effective swim of 3.5 kilometers across.
Do you have to dodge a lot of boats and things like that on the way?
Well, funnily enough, the day I did it back in 2000, I managed to find his pilot and get the permissions and stuff. But the pilot also did say to me, you might have the permissions, but we're still going to be going off at 4 o'clock in the morning when the Coast Guard don't start their shift till 6. So we started very early in the morning. And literally, I remember waiting off the Asian coast and the pilot just waiting there as he looked up and down the Hellespont or Dardanelles to see if there was a break in the traffic. And when there was a break in the traffic, he gave me the signal as I was standing on the shore and basically told me to swim, swim, swim. It's a very busy boat area. This is the same traffic that goes towards Crimea and into the Black Sea in Istanbul. So it's all those boats there going through this very narrow waterway. So yes, we had to get a move on when we saw a break in the traffic.
So having done this, you then thought there are other people out there who would like to do this without the hassle of organization. So that's really how Swim Trek began, was it?
Yes, I think so. And I was passionate about going to places and sort of discovering them by swimming. I think what I loved also was this idea of arriving at a landmass under your own steam and looking back and seeing where you've arrived from, so to speak. I think arriving somewhere and you've powered yourself there makes you appreciate somewhere in a way that somebody, say, who's arrived by ferry or by boat can't possibly do it. It's similar to, say, hiking up Snowdon. Those who've hiked up Snowdon and those who've arrived on the train, I think, appreciate the summit in two totally different ways. And I think the same is when you swim from island to island, you've immersed yourself in the medium of getting there. I think you appreciate where you've arrived so much more than if you'd sort of got there by plane or by ferry. And that's where I get my pleasure out of. And I think people who join us also get that sort of pleasure and also get physically fit as well.
How fit would you have to be to do something like this?
Well, it all depends really on the geography of where you are. So we started off in the Greek Cyclades. The distance roughly between the islands there, there's maybe 6 islands, and we island hop. Instead of getting the ferry, we swim. So our strap line at the time was, ferries are for wimps, let's swim. And that sort of gets the picture across what we're doing. But some of the crossings were 2 to 3 kilometers, and some of the crossings were about 800 meters. But there'll be other places in the Med and the Caribbean where the distances are a lot smaller. So they would be more introductory swims, maybe anything between, you know, 0.5 kilometer to 1 kilometer between islands, which is very accessible for a lot of swimmers. And then other islands are much more challenging, you know, like in the British Virgin Islands, maybe the average distance we're looking is 3 to 4 kilometers per swim. If somebody's able to swim that average distance in one go before they come on the trip, then we send them out a training plan and away they come. So different trips for different fitness levels, I would say.
So you can't take anything with you, though. That's the difference between hiking and swimming.
Yeah, that's true. The more simple, the better. Literally, a pair of swimming trunks, goggles and hat. And that's all you need. It's such a simplified pursuit. And I think in today, when we can get so carried away with the latest Gore-Tex or the latest neoprene or the latest bike that somebody has, I think that simplicity of this sport is something which I'm passionate about. I know lots of other people are as well. And it can be at its core a really basic pursuit. But what you do have alongside you or close by is safety support. So what we tend to do is, as we're hiking, maybe to the start of the swim, but before we start swimming, we put our gear, equipment, whatever we need onto the escort boats. They then double as your safety cover, as well as taking your gear. You then pick that up when you finish your swim. The safety support's always there, which can carry your gear. So even though you're doing it equipment free, your gear is riding alongside you.
Do you organize flights and all travel arrangements, or do people do that separately?
Yeah, no, we don't do the flight. So what they do is people get themselves to the start point, which is generally a hotel on one of these islands or in a location, and people come from all over. I'd say 40% of our clients would be from the UK, 20% from the US, 10% from Australia and another 10% maybe from Germany. I think that leaves maybe another 10% from all everywhere else, really. A real nice mix of clientele and people, and it's a really international product.
And as many women as men?
Yeah, I'd say slightly more women than men, really. Women can achieve at open water swimming just as well as men can. And for example, some of the long distance records which are out there have been set by women. So it's an activity and a pursuit that women are on an equal footing as that men are, which is great. And also age-wise, it's a low-impact sport. You think of running, for example, swimming is low impact. The water absorbs a lot of the impact. So actually, it's an activity that can go on into your late 70s, 80s. We have participants coming in their late 70s, 80s.
So you mentioned the Virgin Islands. There must be a danger with sharks and other things in the water.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, for example, you know, we swim in the Galapagos Islands where we are literally looking for sharks and understanding them and working with the National Park Service on where the sharks are, what their patterns are, and helping understand them as well. I would say, touch wood, we've never been any issues there at all. And I think it's understanding them and actually in quite a few locations going to find them and interact with them because they're incredible creatures. I think what's more concerning tends to be on our trips is other boat traffic. And that's why we have our own safety support going alongside them. So it's actually the man-made stuff that we have to watch out for more, other boat traffic in the water. And that's why we always get local permissions, but also liaise with other mariners. And actually talking about the Virgin Islands, that's that swim there from the British Virgin Islands to the US Virgin Islands is great. It's actually swimming for a reason. Now, we talked about the Hellespont, where you swim for mythological reasons because of Hero and Leander, literal reasons because of Byron, and geographic reasons because you're actually swimming from Asia to Europe. And all of those reasons are, for me, are the things that get me up to make me want to do these swims. So for the Virgin Islands, you're swimming from British Virgin Islands to US Virgin Islands. So saying you've just swum from Britain to America, for me, is a wonderful way of and a reason to get up and actually go and do the swim, as well as seeing some stunning waters, being in a stunning part of the world. The symbolism of it behind it is always an attractive thing for me.
So how far is it from Britain to America in those terms?
Well, the nearest points is about 3 kilometres. So you can go from Norman Island in the British Virgin Islands across to St. John in the US Virgin Islands. That's about 5 or 6, that's about 6 kilometres. But there's a little island in the middle called Flanagan's Island. And Flanagan is part of the US Virgin Islands. And the distance from Flanagan to Norman Island is about 3 kilometres.
So what's the longest swim you personally have done?
The longest swim I've done, that did the English Channel back in 2003. And again, there's significance there, there's symbolism there, isn't there? There's this is Britain's connection with the rest of the world. It's the English Channel has been what fortified Britain, I guess. Last successful invasion of Britain was 1066. So there's a lot of symbolism there. And I think that's why for a lot of people that appeals to them to go and swim the English Channel, because it's significant. And that's why so many more British people have swum the English Channel than French people have swum La Manche. Because for us, it's more symbolic and it's our connection with the rest of the world. For the French, it's their connection with another island just off their north coast. So that's why I think for lots of people, symbolism is important. And I think that's why for me, I was very keen to do that swim. It's sort of considered the Everest of swimming. But also it's Britain's connection with Europe and the rest of the world. That was the longest swim. That's 21 miles.
And here you're dealing with cold water and jellyfish. Yep. Lots of swims that you do and organise are on the chilly side.
Yes. For me personally, I love organising swims and putting swims on that I feel I would love to do. And I love the beautiful waters of the Caribbean and the waters of the Mediterranean. But I also love those sort of slightly more challenging conditions of the waters of the Outer Hebrides, for example, and some of the challenges that entails, such as conditions in the water. You're not always going to get flat conditions. You could have sea swell coming in. You could have your traditional southwesterly wind giving you chop. That can have an effect on the water movement on the surface, which can make the swim more challenging. The wildlife you get there as well, and the water temperature. So all of those challenges kind of, for me, sometimes makes that swim even more appealing. So what I like to do is try and offer some of the idyllic swim locations, which generally are more popular and more attractive for people to come and go on, but also like to try and offer some of the more out there sort of locations. You wouldn't automatically probably think of swimming, but there will be groups of people who maybe come on the more idyllic swims first, who then think, you know what, the Outer Hebrides, that sounds appealing. Or the Lake District, for example, or the backwaters of Oregon, or up in Saskatchewan in northern Canada, going by seaplane, hopping between the lakes up there. They're not your traditional swimming location, but bringing those in and showing that actually you can have amazing swimming experiences there is something I love doing.
So what would you say the iconic world swims are?
Well, I guess everybody's iconic world swims varies. For example, in China, somebody might think swimming the Yangtze after Chairman Mao would be iconic for them, but it's not really iconic for anybody else. So I think it's what is significant for yourself. So for me personally, I love significant swims around the world, which actually means something. And this is also a bit of a challenge. For example, then the English Channel, potentially say the Straits of Gibraltar, which basically guard the entrance into the Mediterranean, but also the divide between Europe and Africa. And also for me, actually, some of the attraction is some of these swims dividing continents. That's what I get excited about. The Hellespont is another one, which divides Europe from Asia. I'd love to go up to Iceland, for example, and swim the gap between the North American plate and is it the European or Eurasian plate, which divides through Iceland. A very short swim, I think, of 5 or 10 meters. So it doesn't have to be physically challenging. I think finding things of symbolism and significance is what gets me excited.
So you don't mind cold water. I like to swim something in Greece or somewhere. It's great, but I'm not too keen on swimming in the English Channel. Let's learn the Outer Hebrides.
Yeah, I just love the differences. Maybe you're swimming 1 week in 30-degree water and then the next you're swimming in 10-degree water. And I think it's that the changes of conditions and the different challenges that each one of those sets you that is something that keeps you coming back for more. I think having the same thing all the time. That's why I like the British climate. You know, last year or the year before, I was living out in Indonesia. And pretty much it was each day was pretty similar to the next, hot, sweaty, and which was nice and lovely for swimming. Did some fantastic swims around Indonesia, but the actual British climate of each day is different, maybe, and the winter is very different from the summer. I find really appealing, and I like that in my swimming as well.
So can you still swim if the weather's very bad?
Well, the good thing about swimming amongst islands is there's generally always a lee side, a spot of the island which is out of the wind. So around the Mediterranean, if you do have, for example, a bad weather system comes in, you can generally always swim in the sheltered part, which is great. If you're dealing with one flat coast, it's very hard then sometimes to get out of that and to actually still have a decent open water swim. So yeah, that's another reason why swimming around island groups is advantageous.
So for anyone who wants to come on a swim trek holiday, yeah, presumably there are different grades of swim.
Yeah, so there's different grades in terms of the average distance that the swimmers are going to be swimming. So one trip might be anything from, say, 1 to 2 kilometers a day, up to some other trips might be something maybe 5 to 6 kilometers a day. So there's quite a big variation in swimming distances based on trips. Some other trips will be down rivers. So, for example, one in the UK, we swim down the River Thames up in Gloucestershire from Lechlade down over a couple of days. So there, even though we're swimming 6 to 7 kilometers a day, the river's pushing us down about half of that. And then on each trip, we'd divide the trip up into fast, medium, and slow groups. And each of those groups have their own safety cover. So we might set the slower group off first, or scenic swimmers, as we like to call them, and they'll go off first with their own safety boat. So you haven't got to feel that you've got to either keep up to a particular speed or alternatively slow down to another speed. So you actually swim at your own speed, which is very important and also allows you to enjoy the experience and allows you to swim with other people of your own speed. So the trips are divided, but also within a trip, we also divide so everyone feels at ease and does it at their own pace.
So do you prefer swimming in the sea to a river or lake?
I love the sea. I love the idea of the salt water on me. But I love swimming in various rivers and lakes. I think the feeling I get with lake swimming is the feeling of sweet water. Salt water is a very harsh environment. You be in there for a number of hours. It's quite abrasive. For salt water, you need to, if you're going to swim longer distances, you tend to grease yourself up. In the old days, that used to be using lanolin, the fat from sheep's wool. These days, you tend to use, unless you're doing a very long distance swim, Vaseline, something like that. And that's in areas where you chafe. So that might be under your arms, between your legs, on your swimming costume lines. And that stops the salt water from basically having this effect of sandpaper. Back to what I was saying, salt water is slightly rougher. Lake water tends to be, I like to call it sweet water. But you can swim and you can drink it as you go. Your hydration source, you're immersed right in it. And you just drink it as you go. Now, not obviously all lakes everyone's swimming in would suggest that, but most of the lakes we go to, you can do that. So again, I love that contrast of the more slightly rougher, harsher salt water, and then the sweeter, more gentler fresh water.
So what about jellyfish and spons and other natural hazards you meet along the way?
Yeah, well, hey, they're all part of the enjoyment and all part of the rich tapestry that is open water swimming. You compare, say, swimming in a pool to swimming in open water, then I would say the differences are you can go to that pool every day for a year, and every day is going to be exactly the same experience. You go into the sea, into a river, into a lake, and every day you swim, you guarantee every day will be a different experience. The tide would be different. The conditions will be different. The weather will be different. Swans, jellyfish, you might get some swans if you're meandering down the River Cam up in Cambridgeshire. And then you also might get jellyfish as you're swimming in Croatia. And the next day you go down, the swans and the jellyfish might not be there. That's what I love about it. Every day is different. When you come across swans, always try and find out where the cygnets are and don't come between the swans and their cygnet. And if you can do that, then they generally leave you well alone. However, if you're meandering down and the cygnets are on one side of the bank and one of the swans is mum or dad is on the other side trying to get food or help building the nest, you might have an issue. So just whenever you see a swan, always just keep an eye out for if there are any cygnets about and don't go in between them.
Because we've had some interesting swimming experiences. We once swam in the Northern Territory of Australia down a river with a guide, and he said, oh, there might be crocodiles here, but you know, you probably won't see any. And in fact, we didn't see any. But do you swim in rivers like that as well?
I've got a memory. My mum was living out when she was alive. She was out in Ghana. She was doing volunteer work out in Accra. And I went to visit her for her 70th birthday, and we traveled around Ghana for 10 days. And we came across the Volta River in eastern Ghana near the border with Togo. We arrived near the mouth of the river, and it was about 6 kilometers across at this point. And there were these little desert islands, like little stepping stones going across. And then I saw somebody in the water fishing. So I spoke to them and I asked them, oh, what's the water here like? And they said, well, this is the only part of the Volta you can really swim, this very small section of where these islands are. And there's people living on all of these islands. And I said, oh, yeah, why is that? He said, well, it's just enough salt that the crocodiles don't come here. And it's just not enough salt that the sharks from the Atlantic don't come in here. So he said there was about this kilometer stretch where these islands were on that actually the locals could go in and fish in the water directly rather than have to do it from land. So then I spoke to him, and then he managed to organize me a boat. And I ended up hopping between island to island over the whole day, visiting the island communities on the Volta River and swimming. So that was using local knowledge of where you can swim and where you shouldn't swim, and actually seeing the locals doing it in action and getting in the water and giving me their advice and sort of copying what they were doing. But instead of fishing, I was just swimming between the islands and hopping across the Volta Rivers.
What about hygiene? I mean, so many waters are polluted these days, and plastic in the water. You see a lot of plastic in the water?
Yes, I think you need to select your swims based on that. I think there's a lot more awareness now of environmental issues, where maybe when I was first swimming, starting out in the 1970s, early 1980s. Most of the places we swim, you don't tend to see much rubbish at all. We tend to try and swim in places which are more out of the way and far from the, you know, trodden path. But there is definitely an awareness there of environmental issues, and it's something that we try and work on and try and work with local communities. But even if the local communities are doing their thing, obviously pollution can be affected from far away. It's a worldwide issue.
And can families come on your trips?
Yeah, families can come. We have a few trips open to families as well, where, you know, maybe some members of the family want to do these exotic swims and others want to just can't think of anything worse. So, you know, it's offering a bit of both. So there's a few locations where we do that as well.
And you also have day trips, I saw, to places like Alcatraz. You can just swim there from San Francisco.
Yes, you can go out to Alcatraz and swim back to San Francisco. It's a relatively short swim. It's about a kilometer and a half. And talking about symbolism, that's an iconic swim and a fantastic sort of crossing. The water temperature gets down to about 16 degrees centigrade, 61 degrees Fahrenheit. That's a wonderful swim. A little tidbit of information, Alcatraz was the only prison in the US prison system that gave their inmates hot showers rather than cold showers. Any idea why?
None at all.
Well, the reason was is so if they did manage to escape out of Alcatraz, when they made themselves get to the water, they wouldn't be acclimatized to the water temperature to swim across. That was the reason why they only had hot showers there. So one thing was doing the swim and obviously understanding what the tides and currents were like. But the other thing was being acclimatized to the water. So they basically gave the inmates as little ability to be able to get across as possible. But yeah, so Alcatraz is a trip you can do in like a few hours, really.
I think I'm right in saying that I've read that no one ever escaped by swimming.
Well, there's three inmates who disappeared after escaping and they don't know what happened to them. Nobody knows. And there was a movie written about it, books written about these three inmates who basically escaped the prison and disappeared from the islands, but no one knows if they actually escaped or what happened to them.
And some tamer one-day swims. You'll take people along the Thames and things like that?
Yeah, so we'll do lots of short one-day trips along the River Thames, which is lovely, a lovely meander, some lunch on the riverbanks and do some walking along the Thames path as well. And then we also do another half-day swim up in Scotland across the Corrie Brechin Whirlpool, which is like the third biggest whirlpool in the world, but it's only a whirlpool at certain times of the tide. We swim across it when it's slack water, where there isn't a whirlpool. But what is nice, go and see it when the whirlpool is at full flow and a full turbulent broth of calamity, and then see what the boats have to put up with when they go through it. And then the next thing is maybe 3 hours, 4 hours later, is to see the whirlpool nice, flat, calm and swimming across it. So the Corrie Brechin is another sort of one-day, half-day trip that we offer, which is a little bit more straightforward. But it's a beautiful swim between Jura and the island of Scarborough.
So at the moment, are you swimming still?
Yeah, so swimming a bit in the sea off Brighton, where I'm based. Ready to go, as all our guides are, when we're able to get out and about again. Number one in the UK. We have a lot of UK guests, but we also have a lot of US guests. So I think our first focus is trips within the UK and trips within the US, and then hopefully at some stage trips overseas as well, which we're really looking forward to getting back into.
Has anything ever gone really wrong on any of your swims?
No, not really. Touch wood. The only thing I remember on my first ever trip we ran was in the Greek Cyclades back in 2003. We were on about our third island. We'd swum two islands and we were staying in different accommodation on each island. And the third island we got to was an island called Koufonissi off the south of Naxos. And we swam there. Big swim. It was about 3.5 kilometers. And we arrived. We then hiked across the island, arrived at the hotel. Pretty tired. Everyone was pretty exhausted. We had a journalist from the Saturday Times on the trip. I learned from that, never take a journalist on your first trip in a particular location. We arrived at the hotel exhausted and met the hotelier who I'd met 2 weeks earlier, quite a few times, exchanged emails, phone calls, everything good, had the rooms booked. She came out and she says, "What are you doing here? I've given all your rooms away." I said, "What?" And he said, well, you didn't arrive on the ferry. It's the only way you can get to the island is arriving on the ferry. And I said, well, no, I explained to you we were swimming here. She said, well, I thought you were just swimming off the beach. So the next 2 hours was spent sitting in the foyer of the hotel watching these forlorn people come out, who basically getting evicted out of their rooms by the hotelier. So not that it particularly went wrong, but it wasn't a great start to our first ever trip. But anyway, from then we made sure that we described to our suppliers and our hoteliers exactly what we were doing. But no, touch wood, I think having the safety cover right there, it's not like climbing a mountain where you know, you're climbing a mountain and you pretty much are on your own. You know, it might be very hard to get medevaced out from anywhere if you do have issues at altitude. But here, as I've said, we do have safety port going very closely alongside with qualified lifeguards looking after you as you go. So again, if there is any problem, swimmers will get out onto the boats and can have a cup of tea on the boat, something like that, watch what's going on, and then maybe join the swim again or just have a rest the rest of the way.
So how big is the boat? How many people can it?
We'll take groups between 10 and 15 swimmers. So the main boat will take all of those swimmers. So lots of space to sort of stretch out on. And then we'll have a couple of inflatable boats with outboard engines who will also look after some of the other groups. So if you want to get out, you then get taken out of one of the boats and then make your way back to the main boat where you can relax. And that takes the whole group, so to speak.
If people want to find out more and book a trip with you, what's your website called?
Yeah, so the website is swimtrek.com. So swim as in swimming and then trek, T-R-E-K. And then all the information's there of all the trips that we do, whether it's from the Galapagos Islands off South America, all the way to the Outer Hebrides in Scotland and everything in between. There's something to sort of entice any swimmer, or also any person who kind of finds swimming enjoyable and enticing and think wants to discover more. And it's all on there. So, yeah. And any questions, give us a shout.
Simon Murray, thank you very much for appearing on Action Pack Travel. And we wish you the very best of luck with SwimTrek.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Felice. Thank you very much, Peter, as well.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the many podcast platforms. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'd love you to sign up for our regular emails, too, at peter@actionpacktravel.com. Until next week, stay safe. And I am you.